The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
We already see the Syrian regime advancing through these Kurdish areas, their surrounding towns, while they're promising the Kurdish leadership to protect the civilians. However, I'm very skeptical about that. There's going to be a lot of civilian casualties on all sides. And there's already like 200 and probably 50 to 300 civilian casualties in the past 24 hours.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 19th, 2019. It's been a horrible week in northeastern Syria. The U.S. abandoned its Kurdish allies after the president had a conversation by phone with Turkish President Erdogan and pulled the plug on the stabilizing U.S. presence in the region. The Turkish government began a major incursion over the border, which has produced significant casualties and major questions about ISIS detainees in Kurdish custody. We got together a heck of a group to talk through it all. Joining me in the first half of the show are Dan Byman and Scott Anderson, both of Brookings and Lawfare, and Gail Tsemach-Lemon joining us remotely. Gail is an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and just finished a book on northeastern Syria. In the second half of the show, we have Ola Al-Rifai of the Washington Institute and Leo West of Carleton University in Canada, both of whom will discuss on-the-ground issues in the region. We're covering a lot of ground, the U.S. side, the Syrian side, the Kurdish side, and the Turkish side. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 462, What's Going On in Syria? Dan, I want to start with you. Give us an overview of what's happened over the last week since the president made his announcement and this Turkish incursion began.
The president effectively greenlights the Turkish invasion by announcing that U.S. troops are going to withdraw and doing so in a conversation with Turkish President Erdogan. With that, you have a pretty massive Turkish invasion along the border designed to secure a safe area roughly 20 kilometers inside. It'll vary slightly depending on where we're talking about. And you have utter chaos that results because this was done without coordination of any sort. So it's a surprise to U.S. soldiers on the ground. It's a surprise to the French and British and other allies. It's a surprise to regional allies. And of course, it's a surprise to our primary proxy in the region, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is a Kurdish-dominated group that had been a close partner in fighting the Islamic State. And this is the number one enemy from the Turkish point of view. And they are suddenly caught where they have to handle a Turkish invasion designed to crush them along the border. So they turn to the Syrian regime and with Russian brokering to kind of fill the gap, to try to assume positions that will blunt the Turkish thrust and as a result preserve the from the Kurds' point of view, some degree of autonomy that may be questionable, but at the very least, the lives and the lives of their families.
Gail,
Talk to us about the various parties involved in this. People kind of throw around the Kurds, the Turks, the Assad regime, the Russians, ISIS. Just walk us through the alignment of forces for a minute. Who's arrayed against whom and why?
I would like to go back to 2014 if we want to look at where we are, which is that the U.S. recruited this proxy force and eventually helped create the Syrian Democratic Forces from what had been a Kurdish force and allied with what is now called the SDF and this whole alphabet soup of who's where and who is fighting whom. The U.S. allied with the SDF, a Kurdish, Arab, and Syrian Christian, Turkmen, other ethnic minorities, religious minorities force to fight ISIS. The Syrian regime had been waging its own battle against those who really sought to overthrow it, starting from the 2011 peaceful protest. But that was separate from what was happening in the ISIS fight. And then the Turks had always been very concerned, Turkey had always been very concerned about who the U.S. had partnered with from back in 2014, because it sees these folks, these Kurds, as too closely aligned with their, enemy number one, the PKK, which is a group that has fought for Kurdish rights and has led armed resistance inside Turkey. So all of that got transplanted into taking what had been a situation of real and fragile stability I have seen for myself six times over the past 2 years and turned it into a 52-part pickup of competing powers and true chaos. And thrown this fragile stability that had been in place because of the U.S.-backed forces and really threw it all into question because Turkey could not be stopped and the incursion happened. And now we're trying to figure out, everyone's trying to figure out what comes next in this moment where Russia really does seem to be determining and shaping facts on the ground.
And you have spent a lot of time there over the last couple of years, as you say. Explain the role of this small U.S. force that the president pulled out. The White House's line about this whole thing has been, 50 U.S. troops can't stop a Turkish army if it wants to invade. The Turks made clear that they were going to do this. To what extent was the presence of those U.S. forces actually impeding Turkey from doing what it has now begun to do?
The presence of U.S. forces has really kept a fragile stability in place. And America was the Oz-like presence hanging over this region that kept everyone else at bay and allowed local forces to focus on the fight against the Islamic State and to bring a fragile stability to moms and dads who are fighting for it every single day against enormous obstacles. And that's Kurd, Arab, Syrian, across the board. The Americans were a force you never saw, but everybody knew they were there. And just the fact that they were there was a deterrent. And that is what people never understood when I was there, was that it would say to me, why don't the Americans see this as a success? And I would say, I really don't know, because it is working. And I was up until the Sunday in which the withdrawal was announced, I was having so many conversations across Washington, really explaining to people what it looked like on the ground, how different it was from Iraq and Afghanistan and these post 9/11 conflicts, which have truly shaped our view of U.S. intervention. And so few people saw the fact that this was a by, with, and through, a partner force that had done exactly what America wanted it to, which had taken the hits, had taken the bullets for the United States and kept this fragile stability in place with only this, invisible American presence hanging over it, keeping Russia out, Iran out, the Syrian regime out, until 10 days ago, Turkey out, and helping local forces who were leading the fight keep ISIS at bay. And that is what has all been placed in jeopardy.
So, Scott, the theory that Turkey has advanced for why it needs to do this and what it is trying to do sounds a lot like U.S. arguments about using military force abroad when local governments are unable or unwilling to deal with threats they face. How legitimate is the Turkish concern about the autonomous region and about the SDF particularly, do they really have links to the PKK that are meaningful enough to justify a significant military operation?
Well, let me go back because I want to add one thing to Gail's answer really quick before I turn to this about the U.S. presence there, which I think everything Gail said is correct about the role the Americans played there. But a big part of this also was the protective umbrella of American air power that was provided to the SDF in substantial part because, at least from a kind of optics and somewhat legal standpoint, of this presence of U.S. troops embedded with the SDF. The United States eventually adopted a legal position saying they could act in the defense of the SDF under a theory of collective self-defense against attacks by third parties. We saw them use this to defend the SDF against attacks from the Assad regime. In theory, they could do the same with the Turks. But a big part of the withdrawal isn't just the withdrawal of these handful of troops. It is actually the fact that President Trump signaled that they were not going to use American air power to defend the SDF. And that is a significant part of this kind of withdrawal concept that's been coming forward. And I just wanted to mention that. In regards to this theory behind the Turkish incursion, the Turks essentially have said, we need a buffer zone. They want to extend their southern border about 30 kilometers into Syria and establish a strip of territory in which they, and specifically their allies, particularly the Free Syrian Army, a kind of local rebel group they're allied with, establishes control. And that means taking control away from the SDF and particularly the Turks. There is no doubt that there are ties between the PYD, which is the kind of Kurdish contingent within the SDF, and the PKK in Turkey. They are ideological fellow travelers. They both abide by a kind of ideology relating to Abdullah Öcalan, which has a very interesting kind of modern Marxist-oriented secularist ideology and kind of communitarian. They have been relations between the two groups. That said, I'm not sure that there is a very strong case to be made that the SDF specifically was threatening Turkish forces. Turkey tends to glom the two together. So when they say, well, we're suffering attacks from the Kurds, the PKK, they say that extends also to the SDF. And I think we would have to look at intelligence assessments and have more information that is probably available in the public sphere to see how much exchange is going back and forth between the two.
Dan?
Just to add very briefly, Turkey has also suffered a series of attacks from the Islamic State. And having the SDF forces working with the Americans was actually a tremendous benefit to Turkey's security to reduce, not eliminate, but reduce that threat.
Take those two things together. You say, well, they've got an Islamic State problem. Yeah, there's a sort of ideological linkage with the PKK, but there's no serious threat to Turkey emanating from the SDF particularly. So, Dan, why does Turkey want to do this?
Turkey, as Scott mentioned, has somewhat of an obsession with the PKK. And to be fair, this was a very active and dangerous insurgent group for decades in Turkish history and did a lot of terrorism as well. So when Turkey looks at the PKK and anything that touches it, they see a grave threat to the Turkish state. In contrast, when they look at ISIS, they see a threat, but not something that's going to shake the foundations of the very nation. Add to that that Erdogan's own political issues and his desire to kind of look tough on the Kurdish issue, that I think that's a pretty dangerous combination. I certainly think they're overreacting to the danger, but it's not a surprising overreaction given their history.
Gail, how easy is it for Turkey to accomplish its military objectives here? And I mean, Turkey is a very substantial military power. This is a kind of pickup militia that has performed very well, but it's not the Turkish military. What do you expect to see in terms of the success of the Turkish operation or the success of this, the SDF's ability to repel it or keep it at bay? And what does the world look like after this incursion is over?
If you look at the reasons why Turkey launched this incursion, it is befuddling if you look at it from the U.S. perspective, because the U.S., until the day that the release about withdrawal happened, was working with Turkey on a security mechanism exactly designed to protect Turkey from its security concerns about the links of the SDF to the PKK. The United States was working very closely, and the U.S.-backed forces had actually destroyed part of their defenses, in part because the Americans said, stick with us and we will protect you, right? If you follow this security mechanism, then we will make sure that you have protection. And so I think that is the big question. Why was the assurance from a NATO ally not enough for Turkey? And I think that is because it sees it as an existential threat, and also because it has 3 million Syrian refugees inside Turkey that is causing a domestic political unrest. And so if you look at what happens next, there are more questions than answers, because who actually withdraws? What does a ceasefire actually mean? And does Turkey have full control over these militias that it has used to go in? And there have been numerous human rights violations. And, you know, I talked to a friend today who's trying to get help for a little girl in a hospital whose leg was injured in the shelling in the town of Qamishli, and whose little brother was killed in the shelling. So this has already had a substantial impact on civilians, on moms and dads. And we wait to see what comes next. The SDF does not have air power. And air power, as we've said, is absolutely defining here. So it is very hard to imagine how they hold out under bombardment. But will we see irregular warfare? What comes next? What is a withdrawal? Is there really a ceasefire? These are all questions that we will see answered in the coming weeks.
Scott, when I think about the things that have happened in the Trump administration that involve, could involve, trigger, will trigger, should trigger a loss in U.S. prestige, this is really high up on the list of events. And, you know, if only because it should make everybody wonder what a U.S. commitment is worth. So you've spent a lot of time not in Syria, but in Iraq. What does it do when the U.S. does something like this?
You know, the impacts that this can have on the credibility of American assurances really shouldn't be understated. That is a very valuable commodity, something that diplomats and American policymakers work very hard to preserve the value of, because a lot of diplomacy, a lot of international relations is about commitments and words. And when you are shown to walk back from them, it becomes a problem. But this also presents, I think, another problem, and that is that it raises fundamental questions about, frankly, the judgment of our commander-in-chief and our ability to preserve even our own interests. There is a case to be made for withdrawing U.S. troops from Syria, a reasonable one. Reasonable people can disagree, but there was not a clear outcome in Syria that didn't end up looking kind of like this outcome without a long-term, perhaps permanent U.S. military presence there, because the SDF doesn't have the ability to defend themselves from an incursion from the Turks or from the Russians/Assad. The SDF was almost certainly not going to reach a reasonable accommodation with the Turks and was probably going to have to end up reaching some sort of arrangement with the Assad regime, which is what we've seen here. The difference, though, is that they could have done it from a better negotiating position with U.S. assistance. U.S. could have facilitated those dialogues. They could have secured U.S. security interests in maintaining, ensuring there's a continued effort to focus on ISIS. They could have done so peacefully in a way that preserves the SDF's political interests, preserves civilians and treatment of civilians. And that was kind of the process that was slowly happening before this in terms of this arrangement that Gail mentioned between the Turks and the SDF, trying to come up with a more permanent arrangement to lower the U.S. obligation there. But by pursuing it in this way so quickly, without advanced planning, without consultation, the United States has shot itself in the foot and compromised not only the interests of its partners, but its own interests in the region as well.
Dan?
To add, making the problem much worse is that it actually fits a broader pattern of the Trump administration. So if we think about this administration, in general, it's pushed U.S. disengagement with critical parts of the world well outside the kind of Syria-Iraq theater. It's been scornful of traditional allies and has not consulted with them on a range of very important decisions. It's actually been willing to see dictatorships grow stronger to gain prestige. And of course, it's been very amenable to Russia. And this particular instance is very painful, but it's painful in part because anyone can look at it and say this is a culmination of a broader set of Trump administration goals and decisions, and it fits a pattern rather than is an exception to it.
And how do you understand the president's personal role here? I mean, as best as I can tell, in December, he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed one day, has a conversation with Erdogan. I believe the Washington Post quotes him back then as saying to Erdogan, all right, I'm done, I'm out, you can have it, or something like that. There's a firestorm, loses the Secretary of Defense, loses Brett McGurk, and kind of backs off, maybe under pressure from Lindsey Graham. Seems to forget about it for 9 months, and then the other day wakes up on the wrong side of the bed again, has another conversation with Erdogan, and says it, and this time he kind of means it. Do we know anything more about the president's decision-making than that, or is that about as good a reconstruction of it as we can put together?
I don't claim to have inside sources, but from everything I know, this was an impulsive decision, and the man has the attention span of a gnat. And so we see this again and again, where these kind of very important decisions are made either without any interagency process or in defiance of what seemed to be an interagency consensus. And that's always a president's prerogative, of course. But what one wants is an intelligent back and forth, where if the president's going to make a decision even that goes against the consensus, it's one that is implemented well and is thought through. And this is the exact opposite.
And Gail, do you think at this stage there is any realistic way to put the genie back in the bottle? Or is this a situation where once you've, you know, pulled the curtain away from the Wizard of Oz, the magic is gone and there is, you know, no further constructive role that the U.S. can play in containing this situation?
I never believe America is out of moves, even though my own personal optimism has been challenged by photos of little people who were shelled and moms trying to figure out, you know, one mom I knew who had found real safety in Ainissa IDP camp for the past 2 years, had all her girls and boys in school, was doing so well working for an NGO. Her whole life is in upheaval, right? She has no home now because the camp was burned in part as there was shelling. Then there she is now out of a job because the NGOs have left, and she's trying to figure out how to take care of her family. So all these moms who were at the front line of the fight against extremism are really thrown into turmoil. But I do believe that America isn't out of moves. I do think perhaps there's a role for an international force that could patrol this buffer zone, this area that Turkey feels insistent upon carving out, and that it will seek to return Syrians to. So perhaps there's a role for an international force. There's definitely a role for U.S. diplomacy, because this agreement raises as many questions as it answers. And different people will define its provisions differently. And there must be a role if people are not going to get caught in the crosshairs and ISIS is not going to take advantage of the chaos, then there must be a role for diplomacy in trying to get people around a table and figure out how to agree upon what the provisions actually mean. So I do think there is a role for an international force and U.S. diplomacy, and we will see if it's exercised.
Scott, I want to ask you about the role of Russia here. One of the things that people have hypothesized about this is that a big winner here is Russia and I guess its proxy, which is the Assad regime. How do you game this out from Vladimir Putin's point of view?
I think this is just about the best way things could have played out from Putin's perspective in this microcosm of this question of the SDF. The SDF had the potential to be a source of resistance to efforts to, you know, reassert Assad regime's control throughout major parts of Syria. The Russians and Assad regime have shown openness of working with the SDF to some extent. The SDF has reciprocated to some extent. There's always been lines of communication between the two. The question was always, what terms would that happen? Here, the SDF's entire negotiating leverage has been taken away from them. They really don't have much of a case to be made to be able to fight for the federalism that they wanted, the autonomy that they wanted within the Syrian state. At least much of it has been taken away, if not all of it. And so from that perspective, this is a big win for him. It makes things a lot easier. He's still inheriting and now owns, in a way, a very complicated situation, a very complicated question. I think Russia is going to have many moments of buyer's remorse about the degree of influence it now wields in Syria as it wrestles with these situations. But that has been Putin's goal. And from the perspective of working towards his goal, I think it's hard to see this as anything but a win.
Dan, so give us your best optimistic scenario, you know, given the magnitude of the disaster that we've seen over the last week and a half. What's the best case scenario in your estimation?
So there's a couple different problems, right? So one that many Americans are rightly focused on is what's going to become of the Islamic State. And there is a potential for some degree of comeback. There may be prisoners who are released that will swell the Islamic State's ranks. The SDF is understandably going to focus on Turkey. And so the number one ally against the Islamic State in Syria will have other priorities. But the Islamic State in Syria was hit pretty hard. It's underground, and it certainly will have more freedom of operation, but it will still be under pressure. And it is quite plausible that Russia and Syria and their Iranian allies, for their own reasons, will be pretty aggressive against this group. It's also plausible that the United States will continue to strike it from nearby Iraq or from other areas. So there could be a lot of pressure on the group. Even though I do think it'll get stronger, I'm not sure it's going to rebound as much as many people fear. Another hope is that there'll be some degree of stability in Syria. Now, it'll be stability under a very tough Turkish regime in the new area they're carving out. It'll be a brutal stability under Assad. But there have been, you know, almost a decade of horrific civil war. And, you know, it's a really tough choice between horrific dictatorship and horrific civil war. I don't want to diminish this. But that said, this is a horrible war, and maybe this will diminish it somewhat. So those are two areas of potential optimism from what is overall clearly a negative set of developments.
Gail, do you see any reason to take an optimistic view of it along those lines? Or is that Dan gamely answering my question in a fashion that's in fact unrealistic?
It was an adroit answer to an impossible question. And so I would say that we want to hope that stability could come back. And I think it's important to note that in the autonomous regions, there was a real, you know, sense of different groups participating. I spent a lot of time with Arab women who were part of local governance. So all of that, you know, all of these people who took step forward in their lives, that looks like it will be in an end, but we don't know. And I think I hate to be pessimistic until we see what facts on the ground turn out to be in the coming weeks, because what gives me hope is all these people you meet who have taken an enormously bad set of cards and turned them into a hand that they had played fairly successfully for the past half decade, given all the carnage around them, and has really tried to build something better upon the ashes of the ISIS fight. Will that continue? Will the U.S. play some role in keeping the worst of atrocities from happening? We will see. And so what it gives me some level of optimism is that I think people have managed to create a little bit of hope in even some of the most grim moments, which I have had the privilege of seeing, and with a very fragile situation have managed to keep some gains in place. And I think it's important to note that those gains are also in America's interest, because fragility is actually sowing chaos right now inside Syria and allowing a vacuum which the Islamic State and other actors are going to fill.
Scott, I want to close with you in this segment. Both Dan and Gail have mentioned this apparent ambition of Erdogan to settle large numbers of Syrian refugees in this buffer zone in northern Syria that they're going to create. That obviously raises a rather substantial legal questions, as does any kind of long-term Turkish presence on Syrian soil. Without getting into too long a disquisition on the law of occupation and settlement of occupied territories, is there any plausible way for him to do that without committing war crimes?
You know, it certainly is in serious tension with the Erdogan government's international legal obligations on a number of fronts. Only some I would qualify as war crimes. You know, there's the Refugee Convention, which is not inherently relates to war crimes, but, you know, returning people to a situation that seems unsafe in which they have credible concerns about being persecuted is in clear violation of that. Perhaps they will argue that they are securing enough of this area that they can promise that that's not the situation. That's unlikely. Moving large populations, resettling, upsetting up new governments is not what's supposed to happen under occupation, at least not where it's strict, narrow military necessity. You know, the problem here is that the credibility is hindered a little bit on the United States' part and on many other countries' part, because that is arguably, I think there are differences, but arguably very similar to what we did do in Syria in combating the Islamic State. We saw a terrorist threat across the border, in this case, across the border of Iraq, and we moved in and we ended up setting up these local governance structures. Now, that's different from directly administering a territory. This is a local indigenous force, and I actually think there's a legal distinction there, and that does make it somewhat more justifiable. But from an optics perspective, you know, we're in a difficult position. The rules, the usual rules of state sovereignty have not really applied in Syria for a long time now. And that makes these sorts of assertions of force more difficult to criticize on the kind of legal rhetorical level. There may be technical legal distinctions we can make, but in terms of the large optics, large kind of public persuasion points, they look a lot muddier. The situation is more difficult to distinguish.
Scott, Dan, Gail, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to join you.
We are joined now by Ola Al-Rifai, a fellow at the Washington Institute in Near East Policy. Ola is a Syria specialist and a Syria native who came to the United States as an asylee before the current Syrian civil war began. And joining by phone is Leah West, who is a professor of national security law at Carleton University in Ontario. She has spent a lot of time dealing with Canadian ISIS detainees of late and has recently come back from the region that we are talking about. Welcome to you both. I want to start, Leah, you were only recently in the relevant area of Syria for reasons related to Canadian detainees there, but I'm interested in your sense of how stable or unstable the region was when you were there, and what the governance situation was before the other day when it got suddenly disrupted.
Yeah, so I moved into the region from Iraq, and the border was very controlled. The situation was well in hand by the autonomous administration, and it was actually rather routine. Moving into the region from east to west, there were many checkpoints, but the documentation that we were provided at the border was accepted by the checkpoints. We had no problem. It was very orderly. There was a lot of reconstruction going on in the area. People seemed to be just generally trying to return to their lives and rebuild. Within the camps, some of the camps, like Rouge, for example, where there's less people being housed there, were very well controlled. There was no issues. Al-Hol was a very different situation. We actually witnessed a riot there, which is a different subject. But in terms of administering day-to-day lives, the autonomous administration of Northeast Syria really had things under control. There were parts of Syria where, you know, we were told by our fixers, don't hang out there for, you know, half an hour or longer, make sure you're moving. This was largely in Raqqa, where there are still cells of ISIS in the area. And there were other towns as well. And even within towns that were like Qamishli, for example, which are, you know, where the autonomous administration has a lot of their kind of, you know, their administration is set up, there still were Syrian regime controlled regions within those cities, but they were very distinct, right? This is where the Syrian regime was. They stayed on the inside of their fences. Everybody else kind of moved around it. And there wasn't a lot of intermixing. So the autonomous administration really did seem to have a grip on the region.
Ola, is that your sense as well? The autonomous administration, was it a functional sort of civil administration of this region? Was there any, you know, urgent need for a Turkish intervention?
Definitely not. There is no urgent need for any Turkish intervention. I do believe that the Kurds in the Rojava region, and they proved to be able to govern themselves, provide services, although limited, because, you know, because of the current regional dynamics and how they are, you know, the war in Syria in general affecting them. But yes, it was, in my opinion, it was a successful, and I hope that it will continue to be a successful experiment that they had for a few years. And they defended themselves against ISIS, and the U.S. backed them. I can't recall another alliance where the U.S. was, you know, successfully partnering with the democratic forces and entity that would fight ISIS and, like, effectively do it. And then all of a sudden now we see the troops are out of that area and the SDF is feeling betrayed, which is a huge mistake, in my opinion. But yeah, I've met with officials from that autonomous government. I've met with civilians from that lived, and they go inside and leave Syria and come to the U.S. to brief people. And it seemed for the past years, it seemed that they were able to, yeah, pick themselves up and rebuild and feel confident and protect their civilians and have... And it was very hopeful. And this is what's happening today. The past 24 hours is very disruptive, in my opinion.
So explain for us the relationship between the autonomous governance structure and the Syrian government. In the wake of the Turkish intervention and the U.S. abandonment of the field, the Kurdish forces have formed some kind of a relationship with the Syrian regime. What's the nature of that relationship both today and 2 weeks ago?
I mean, I will have to also mention, like, historically, what has the relationship been historically with the Kurds, between the Kurdish minority in Syria and the Assad regime? Historically, the Assad regime has always cracked down on them. They have always been discriminated against on all levels, different levels. Today, or since 2011, I mean, the Kurds were part of the revolution, the initial revolution in 2011, calling for freedom and democracy in Syria against dictatorship, against this regime. The Kurds, I have so many Kurdish, I'm not Kurdish myself, but I have so many Kurdish friends of mine who were imprisoned and tortured and then found, you know, refuge in the U.S. That's like early in 2011, 2012. They came to this country because we were all on the same page, Sunnis, Arabs, Kurds. A lot of Christian friends of mine and activists on the ground, even some of the Alawite community that was also calling for regime change and end of dictatorship. So the Kurds really have suffered for many, 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 like, decades, if not longer, from this brutal dictatorship. Today, the Assad regime doesn't really, I mean, for him, it's a huge win what's going on right now, for him and his allies, mainly Iran and Russia. For him, he's letting the Turks do what they're doing in northeastern Syria in order for him to also kind of, like, consolidate so-called control, although I don't believe he does have control or he has any forces like him himself. It's mostly Iranian militias and the IRGC, which are going to fill the vacuum of the U.S. troops, you know, because of their withdrawal, which is another threat to national security, to the region, and to our security here too, because of, you know, what Iran does in the region in general, how it is, you know, trying to present itself as a big force in decision making, and which is against what the American interests are. Anyway, so backing the SDF and the autonomous government is not something that the Assad regime wanted to have, I mean, or approve of, let's put it that way. They never really wanted it to happen for their own, you know, reasons. However, they kind of let it happen. And when they saw the U.S. was backing, you know, the SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces, and helping them, you know, the Assad is not going to be, like, doing anything about that or fighting back the U.S. or so forth. But now it's going to be different because we already see the Syrian regime advancing through these Kurdish areas, their surrounding towns. Well, they're promising the Kurdish leadership to protect the civilians. However, I'm very skeptical about that, personally. There's going to be a lot of human, you know, civilian casualties on all sides. The Kurds have always suffered, and there's already like 200 and probably 50 to 300 civilian casualties in the past 24 hours. Some towns are under siege. The Turks may stop bombing. We don't know. Let's see what's going to happen with the ceasefire. But although I don't believe in it, because the situation there is really complicated. But at the end of the day, Assad, it's all playing in favor of what the regime wants, which is consolidating control, bringing back those terrorism elements that are, you know, ISIS fighters are leaving some of the prisons. They're going to resurrect, in my opinion. They might do some attacks. And then Assad regimes will be like saying, oh, we're fighting terrorism and we're advancing, and he will become the hero again, you know, or pretend to be. So it's very complicated.
Leah, talk about the ISIS reconstitution question. It's clear that what brought you there, obviously, was Canadians detained as potential ISIS fighters. But I'm interested in how you assess the actual risk of significant ISIS reconstitution as a result of the Turkish operation and people leaving camps in response.
So I think it's important to note that, I mean, informed listeners of this podcast understand that, you know, while the caliphate no longer existed, ISIS by no means was defeated. ISIS still controlled regions in Rojava, and they still were executing successful cell-like attacks in areas of northeastern Syria. And Baghdadi had, about 2 weeks before I was there, put out a statement basically reminding his followers in the camps that they had not been abandoned, and kind of emboldening them to act out. And we were actually seeing that taking place inside the camps while I was there. I mentioned that I witnessed a riot.
And just to be clear, how many people are we talking about who were in these camps?
So in Al-Hol, there are 70,000 people, women and children. Inside the camp, there is a separate annex of 11,000 foreigners, so individuals who are not from Syria or Iraq. And inside that annex is really where we see the hardliners. A lot of, from what I've been was told by Kurdish officials at the camps, generally the hardliners were made up of Chechen women, some North African women, but there were also Western women as well, who were reconstituting the Hizbah, or the morality police that we'd heard about in the communities that ISIS controlled inside the caliphate. They were reasserting kind of the ISIS ideology, and women who had, you know, when they first come to the camps, who may have wanted to free themselves of the rules under which they've lived under ISIS, you know, and taken off their niqabs or the hijab. And now, you know, every woman in those camps has the niqab back on, because the women of ISIS still control the inside of these camps. And so the image that I had as I was leaving Al-Hol was that ISIS wasn't dead. It was just being held at bay behind these precariously walled camps by limited Kurdish forces. And it was very clear to me that if those Kurdish forces and Kurdish police were going to be diverted away, or if that something spurred on the tens of thousands of people behind those fences, that they weren't going to hold. And I think that this is the true risk. So ISIS can use this chaos, the human atrocities that are going to take place, as a way of reinvigorating his message, reaching the women, using the opportunity to either create breakouts. We saw the initial reportings were 850 people out of Anissa camp were escaped. There's reports that in prisons, so the male fighters are held separately in more robust prisons, not camp-like structures, that there's been some breakouts of Western fighters. Two Belgians were confirmed to have escaped. So do I think that ISIS is going to use this and reestablish a caliphate in the region? No. Do I think that this adds to their message, fuels their fire, gives them the voice and the ability to show their followers around the world that ISIS still lives and the ideology still lives and a way of motivating its followers to take action on its behalf? Absolutely. This is just more fuel to show that, you know, the West doesn't care about this region and that everything that they've been saying about the West is correct, and to call on its sympathizers to act out against the West.
Yeah, I agree with you, Leah. I wanted to add to that as well, that we need not to forget Idlib. What's going on in Idlib too, and the Al-Qaeda group, it's calling itself Hurras al-Din in Idlib, and there have been a lot of reports about their activities or in there. They're also mobilizing. So it's not just the threats are, what I want to say, are not just ISIS by itself, but also Al-Qaeda, which is going to take advantage in northern Syria and then move towards the east if there is a vacuum, and do things that are going to be harmful to civilians and to regional security and international security. In addition to that, I mean, the SDF that just the U.S. just abandoned, they were protecting, I mean, or guarding those prisons, but they don't have the power to, now what they care about is just protecting themselves and their civilians in their areas. So for a whole camp, what I know is that there was 400 guards only for like 70,000 people, which is nothing, you know. It's and the numbers, I heard from General Mazloum, who was the head of the SDF and the commander there, who sent a letter recently to Trump about what's going on, like, please don't do that, don't withdraw. He said that the number of the guards that were protecting a whole camp, for example, and other camps in the area are decreasing because these guys need to fight at the front lines because of the Turkish invasion right now. So it's very, very terrible what's going on, and the U.S. has miscalculated this move, and I hope, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to say it's too late to go back and try to fix this, but hopefully we can if we have the right, you know, minds and the will to reverse this catastrophe.
And Leah, how should we understand the Turkish objective here? You have a self-governing region that is, by both of your accounts, essentially functional, although with problems. You have a traditional Turkish anxiety about anything that smacks of Kurdish nationalism, particularly in this case, an alleged relationship between this organization and the PKK. How do you evaluate the Turkish or understand the Turkish hostility and goal here? Is the goal simply to obliterate anything that smacks of Kurdish autonomy? Or is there some more specific grievance going on here involving the SDF?
I think it's probably twofold. I don't think that Erdogan would ever stipulate that his intent is, you know, the obliteration of the Kurdish peoples or a Kurdish state, but essentially that's what he's doing under the guise of anti-terrorism or counter-terrorism efforts. Realistically, my understanding of this situation is that his intent is to dilute Kurdish control of the region by resettling a large portion of the 3 million refugees that are in Turkey as a result of the years-long conflict in Syria and to some extent in Iraq as well, into the region. So the idea would be to clear the border region, so the region's most directly threatening to Turkey, of SDF forces and resettle largely Arab populations into that region, therefore diluting Kurdish control and eventually diluting the idea of autonomy in the region for the Kurds, because they no longer would be able to kind of control and govern this region, that there would be an effort potentially by the populations to be more friendly to Turkey or to more friendly to the Syrian regime, that would kind of break apart the glue that's been holding together Rojava and the autonomous administration, so that it would dilute the chance or decrease the chance of like a strong state forming, which would obviously potentially inspire Kurds in Turkey as well to the idea of creating their own regional administration. That's my understanding. Of course, he's saying it's about, you know, PKK and counterterrorism and counterterrorism threats that Turkey is facing. But I think everyone sees through that pretty clearly.
All right. So, Ola, you left long predating the current war, but you're a Sunni Arab from Syria. And I'm curious for your sense of the plausibility of Erdogan's theory here. You have a very large number of Arab refugees, Syrian Arab refugees in Turkey, who he wants to kind of move into this Kurdish region. And they're not from that region of Syria, right?
Exactly.
How delusional is this?
He's sending many of them. They're going to be forced to go back. Some people don't want to go back. You know why? Because they're going to face a death sentence by the Assad regime. That's something that's being ignored right now in the discussion about this whole issue. People who left Syria as refugees, many of these people were targeted by the Assad regime because they protested against the Assad regime and they ran away to protect what's left of their families. Some people may return, some people may want to return, but there is another side of the issue. Like, people are going to go and face their death, basically. They might just be targeted immediately at the borders or arrested, or you never know. So it's very hard to imagine how bad this is going to, like, it's beyond imagination how bad this would be.
So you have here a situation where the goal seems to be to move a large population that probably doesn't want to be moved into an area of the country where the local population doesn't want them to be moved. Why does he think he can? This sounds so unrealistic to me that I'm sort of skeptical as to why he thinks he can do it.
Erdogan thinks he can do it. I honestly, I don't know why. I don't think he's pushing for it. I don't know if he's convinced that it is feasible.
But you don't think it's really about sort of antagonism to the SDF and its his sort of historic relationship with the PKK?
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. Of course it is. I think part of it is that his, you know, the Turkish PKK relations that are has been always been very negative, and moving Arabs into areas that have been where Kurds have lived in the past, or Kurds and Arabs lived, or majority Kurds, some towns and some towns have, you know, less Arabs. Sometimes they're mixed. Anyways, it's unrealistic, of course. It's going to cause harm to these individuals that are going to be forced to go in there from Turkey. It's going to cause local, he's changing the demographics. The Kurds are going to be resentful. On top of like the civilians, on top of the issue of Turkey bombing their areas, also repopulating the areas, their hometowns with, you know, foreign, you know, Syrians, but not foreign to those towns, not from there. I think this whole thing is gonna it's opening a can of worms. I feel, and it's very complicated and terrible on different levels. And not realistic, but does Erdogan think realistically? I don't think so, you know.
So, Leah,
so it's not surprising.
How should we understand today's ceasefire? It seemed to me to read like it was the Trump administration sort of gleefully announcing a Kurdish surrender. Is there a more optimistic way to understand it than that?
I have a more pessimistic understanding of it. Definitely not a more optimistic one. To me, it's a way of pushing the pressure off of Trump at home, I would think, changing the news story for 5 days. I don't know why the Trump administration feels that they can negotiate on behalf of the YPG that they just abandoned. And quite frankly, the Syrian and Russian forces who are now in the region that are apparently going to be subject to this ceasefire, immediately following Vice President Pence's remarks, spokespeople for the autonomous administration and the SDF said, we appreciate the ceasefire, but we are not allowing the Turks to invade our country. So ultimately, what's going to happen is maybe there'll be a ceasefire for 5 days. That would be nice. But at the end of the 5 days, Trump can turn around and point the finger at the Kurds who have refused to leave their territory, and the Syrian forces who have refused to leave their sovereign territory, and make them the bad guys and say, look, Turkey gave you a chance. We negotiated in bad faith. You guys are now the bad guys. And you know what? Turkey, go ahead. So I know that that is cynical, but at this point, I really just see it as a way of Trump changing the narrative, because the idea that he can somehow broker a deal on behalf of the people that he just abandoned, and that now the Syrians and Russians who also have a stake in this are going to go along with it, is laughable.
Well, one of the things that we always hear about the Kurds in northern Syria is that they're the most capable fighting force in this sort of anti-ISIS coalition.
They proved it, yeah.
And that they're...
And many of them died fighting ISIS.
Yeah, so that they had 11,000 deaths. The Turkish army is the second largest army in NATO. It's a very capable fighting force. How easy will it be, or is it proving to be, for the Turkish army to roll into these areas? And how capable are the Kurdish forces of defending them from a Turkish incursion?
So far, it's been proven. I'll just say very briefly, they haven't been rolling over the SDF. And the SDF has been saying, you know, if the United States had kind of retained control over the airspace in the region, it would have been an entirely different game. But they've lost the air war, but should Russia move in and control the airspace, they haven't yet, but they have been flying sorties in the region, that'll also change the nature of the game.
I agree. I agree with Leah, and I don't think the Kurds are able to, you know, they're weak. I mean, they were able to defend themselves and with this support from the U.S., but now they don't have that support. They're desperate right now. So if they're facing the Turks or they're facing the Russians or the Assad regime, I don't know, you don't trust the Assad regime, even if they're trying to kind of strike a deal with them. It's like, you know, they are left basically alone in this fight. And I don't see anything hopeful in this scenario if it stays the way it is and if the U.S., you know, is not going to reconsider what it's doing in terms of this issue.
Thank you very much to you both.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to all our guests who joined us from all over the place. Some of them in the room, some of them remote. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineers this week were Michaela Fogel and Jacob Schultz. You should do your part to be promoting the Lawfare podcast, because if you're not, then you're really part of the problem. We don't advertise. We don't, you know, do any kind of promotion of the Lawfare podcast other than asking you guys to tweet it, share it on Facebook, and of course, leave us a rating on whatever podcast distribution services you use. You should be buying Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. You should be talking about the Lawfare podcast at dinner parties and making yourself annoying about it. Our music is Now As Ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And of course, thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.